Good. Sometimes I have the traumatic experience of going shopping with my wife. It's traumatic not because of what she spends, but it's traumatic, and she's not here this morning. It's traumatic because she can never decide what to buy. And there are certain places, I know in this world we live in, we're not supposed to distinguish between the sexes, but I think that's nonsense. There are certain places where men fear to go. And you're all thinking about the lingerie department in Father Ted, I know. But actually, it's often something to do with cosmetics. It's a world that is alien to us. We don't understand it. We can't get our heads around it. And, you know, if we go shopping and we go into a very large boots chemist, really purgatory comes to mind. It's the most boring shop in the world. And, you know, there are literally thousands and thousands and thousands of square feet of shop space selling stuff that you put on your face. How does that work? See, I reckon that all you need is shower gel and shaving gel and a razor. You need some deodorant. You need some toothpaste. Maybe some antiseptic for when you cut yourself, which I'm always doing, and a packet of plasters. That'll do. What? Hankies. All right, hankies. We use kitchen roll in our house. We're not posh like you, Ian. Okay. But what is the rest of it for? And I stand there, and I just see all of this stuff, these lotions and these potions, and I can't imagine what you girls do with it. It is an absolute enigma to us men. And then my wife will say, you know, I don't think I can quite find what I'm looking for. I think I'll come back next week. I think I'll look online. Look! What do you need that is not here? There we are. Thus is the life of a husband. If you boil it all down to a basic need, it's really dead simple, isn't it? For those of you who can't see, you're squinting. It's a bar of soap. It's a bar of soap. Love is the basic ingredient of all things pastoral. We get into all kinds of complexities, all sorts of shapes and colours. We lay our stalls out with all kinds of elements of what pastoral care means, according to the generation, according to the way we relate to each other, according to our culture. But the foundational ingredient of Boots the Chemists, probably, if I had to ask you to say in one word or two words, what is it all about? You would probably say, or I think I would probably say, personal hygiene. Is that fair? You could say it's about looking nice, or there's all kinds of stuff they sell these days. But in the end, it's about keeping ourselves up together. The basic foundational ingredient of pastoral care is love. Our circle, I started calling it the circle of purpose. I thought that sounded rather good. But it's our five principles we're working through. Worship, pastoral, community links, youth and children's work, and practical. And those five purposes encircle our church's mission statement. Trinity is a welcoming church seeking to live in the love of God and share the message of Jesus Christ. I asked you a few weeks ago, what do you think is the most important of those five principles? And I declared to you, you can claim that it's subjective on my part if you wish, that's up to you, but I claim that the most important thing is worship. because there is absolutely nothing that we can do in this world that is more important than worshiping God revealed to us in Jesus Christ. I would even go so far as to say it's the reason he created us in the first place, because he likes our company. And so worship is key. But if you ask me which of those five key principles binds the rest together, I would probably say it's pastoral. And that's what I'm talking about this morning. Because pastoral means care, and care means love. The dictionary talks about pastoral as being something that offers maybe guidance or advice in one context or another, or help. But it is the giving of care. And I would say that it's pastoral that binds all the other five together. Because love is the foundation of being pastoral. And as Kevin read to us from 1 John, it is love that binds us as the people of Christ. And unless we love, we can't live in God. And if we live in and with God, then we are bound to love. So this loving each other thing is a very interesting subject. It's gone a bit kind of gooey over the years. And I have a theory that a lot of men don't like going to church because we sing love songs to Jesus. And it kind of doesn't work with most blokes. It doesn't work. It just doesn't work. And I think what we need to do in our pastoral care is redefine what we mean by love. Love needs to come away from meaning something all gooey and soppy. There's a place for that in close relationships, of course. But in the context of the church family, we need to transpose love into a thing which is cast iron certainty, something that is something to really strive for, something more warrior-like, something more certain, something with a sharp edge to it that has a more of an objective feel to it. We tend to think about love as being, it's a silly sentence. We tend to think of love as being what we do to each other. Like it's some sort of commodity, something we expect other people to do to us. Sometimes we'll hear someone say in a church, "I really don't feel very loved," as if it's something that we expect the rest of the church to do to us and for us, a commodity to be shared around. But when Jesus said, "Love one another as I have loved you," I think he was saying more than what we do for each other and the way we relate to each other. I think he was talking about a way of being. When we say God is love, we're saying that his very nature is love. Yet when we speak about it with each other, we talk about doing love, don't we? Which is very different to actually being love. Jesus loves us with who he is. And that is that what that means is that everybody that he comes into contact with receives his love, because he can do no other, because that's who he is. Whereas what we tend to do is pick and choose. I know I do. I find it easier to love some people more than other people, because that's part of our human nature, and I would imagine we're probably all the same. Jesus didn't pick and choose in his divine state. Because he was love, he naturally brought that love into contact with no matter who. It doesn't mean he liked people. It doesn't mean he got on well with everybody. It doesn't mean he patted everybody on the head. Sometimes he turned the tables over and shouted at people. Sometimes he was intensely angry and deeply bitter and sad. What must he thought of Herod, who took his cousin's head off when he heard the news? He just went out in a boat on his own, probably to cry his heart out and shout at those who had damaged John the Baptist irreversibly. Let's get out of this very strange fairy tale idea that Jesus had no sense of irritation with other people. He just loves everyone. He loves us all. How nice. What a load of rubbish. He loves us all, but he loves us with a different type of love. With a different type of love. And we'll talk about that in a moment. The love that he has for us is irrespective of what we feel about ourselves. Irrespective of how we rate ourselves, how much we love ourselves. Some people think God could never love me because of what I do and what I think and the way I am. And that's a misunderstanding of this nature of God. It's like standing in a very dark room and somebody walks in with a torch. And you say to that person, "This room is so dark, your torch could never light it up." To which the answer is, well, actually, it doesn't matter how dark the room is. This torch is going to light it up because it's light and light dispels darkness. It just does. It can't do anything else. A torch or a flame cannot burn and not light the room. It just cannot be done. It is just part of its being. And the love of Jesus for us is like that. He cannot be. God is love. He cannot do other than love us because that is his nature. And if we have seen Jesus, we have seen the Father. And so we know that he loves us through and through. But here's the rub. In the reading that Kevin brought to us, there is this incredible command. Once you've got your head around that bit, suddenly we're told to love each other in the same way. Ah, now, wait a minute. That's pushing it too far, isn't it? God loves me because his nature is love, and he can do no other than love me, no matter what my response is. In the same way that Jesus loved those who banged the nails into him on the cross. And God says, now I want you to do likewise. The bar's getting a bit higher, isn't it? It's all very well God loving me like that, but to ask me to love my neighbor, have you met my neighbor? That's what we're all thinking. And so it's really, really important that we recognize that actually this is reachable. And it has a profound impact on the pastoral care of the church. Our difficulty is when we talk about loving each other, we think we have to like each other. We think we have to have a real, genuine sense of, I want to be sacrificial for this person. It's something that I do. It's a matter of will. I'm going to really try and help that person who irritates me. And it all goes against our human nature. It's like those opposing magnets we used to have in the science labs at school. Do you remember that? Used to never listen to what the teacher said, but used to like playing with the magnets, and you push them together and they won't go. It feels like that when we're trying to love those. And that's because we're trying to do love to other people. We're trying to do something for them. When we are love, when we change our our persona, but our DNA changes, actually we don't have to try to do anything because we just are. Jesus just was love. In John 21 is the very significant story, we won't talk about it now because I've preached on it before, of the restoration of Peter after the resurrection. After Peter's denial, you remember? And Jesus rises from the dead. Jesus restores him and asks him three times, "Do you love me?" He's asking, "Do you agape me?" Because the Greeks, of course, were much smarter than we are. And they had quite a few different types of love. There are actually five or six or even more. But the ones that we refer to most often are filio, which is a brotherly love, a kind of brotherly sister, link arms, we're in this together kind of love. There's eros, which is a sexual, erotic love. There's storge, which is a family love, a kind of love for a parent has for a child, the child has for a parent. And there's agape. Agape is unconditional love. Unconditional love. What does unconditional mean? It means unconditional. It means it has no conditions. And Jesus, in the passage that we've heard from today in 1 John, of course in our translation it's just got the word love. But if you look at the Greek, it's agape. The love in this passage in 1 John chapter 4 is agape. It's not filio. It's not mates at the bar drinking pints together and having a boyish time. It's not girls going shopping together like sisters to go and buy out Boots the Chemist. It's agape. Agape is unconditional. In any situation, in any circumstance, it's not relevant, the external circumstance is not relevant. The thing that we come up against is not relevant, whether it's the smelly beggar on the street, or whether it's the neighbor we don't get on with, or whether it's the clash of something, relationships at home or at work. Irrelevant. Agape is unconditional. It means that I meet whatever it is with the same love. Now, the bar is enormous. The bar is absolutely huge. It really is very, very difficult. But it's possible. It's possible. And I think that John is saying that if we are truly in God, and God is truly in us, then love for each other is a basic norm. If God's nature is love and we claim to love God, then actually we can do no other but than love each other. Now, I'm a great fan of the books of Bernard Cornwell, and David Jones is as well, and he and I swap books and talk about them quite a lot. Bernard Cornwell is a wonderful historical writer, and lots of stuff about the rise and fall of kingdoms and soldiering in the Dark Ages and in the Middle Ages. I just have a bit of an anorak kind of interest in those times. And occasionally in those books, there'll be a reference to a soldier who's just had a bath, probably in a stream or under a waterfall. And when a man became clean, there is comment in the text that others notice that the smell and the grease and the lice are not quite so prominent on you today. Because the norm was a much lower level. Does that make sense? It was normal to be dirty. And so when people had a bath or got washed, somebody would say, "Oh, you've had a bath. Yes, my lady, first one for 3 months." And that was absolutely, I know that sort of thing doesn't go on in Surrey, but it certainly went on in Wales in the 5th century. Now, in our culture today, that would be unacceptable, wouldn't it? That would be really unacceptable if somebody came in at the back, although we welcome everybody. If somebody came in who hasn't had a bath for a year, one of us would probably have to go and say, "Look, I think you need to do something about this." We'll appoint Jean to do that. She's not here, so we can vote her in to do that. But we would, wouldn't we? We'd have to do something about it. And the reason is, it is assumed in our culture that the basic norm is that we would keep ourselves clean, that we would actually have a certain standard of regular baths and showers. The basic standard norm has been raised hugely. So our bar of soap that I showed you earlier is very normal in all our homes. And we would expect each other, and we teach our children, that you must use this regularly, every day. All those millions of square feet of products that you girls put on your faces that Boots sell are actually they're extra bits. But you would all agree with me, if we went camping in the Pennines for 6 months, you would have to leave your hairdryer at home. I don't think Sam would go camping, actually, no. There's no electricity, is there? No hot running water? No, you see? Standards very... No toilet. Very high standards has Sam. The Cudby family are right up there when it comes to standards. Me? Oh, I'm way above that. No. But you see, you would agree, wouldn't you? By the way, what is foundation? My wife talks about foundation. My daughter the other day, she said, "What is foundation? What is it? Is it like some sort of primer or something? I mean, is it? Is that what it is, like primer undercoat?" I've never understood it. Isn't it a mystery? It is a complete mystery. You know, you like open the drawer. If I go into our bedroom and I'm looking for something, and I'll open one of the drawers in the chest of drawers, like one of Lizzie's drawers. I mean, you've never seen anything like it. I mean, what do you do with this stuff? It's not just one drawer. It's one on top of the other. Here are bottles and tubes and stuff you brush on and stuff you spray on. And it's a mystery. Anyway, sorry, I digress. You can tell that we have a problem with this. But, you know, the standard has risen, hasn't it? The standard has risen. John says to us, and I'll read to you verse 7. "Dear friends, let us love one another, for love comes from God. Everyone who loves has been born of God and knows God. Everyone who loves has been born of God and knows God." Love is the foundation. Love is basic. It's the bar of soap. It's just the basic thing. We cannot function without this agape love as a real church, in a real community, in a real way. So the way that we express our love for each other with our pastoral care, the good works, the kind deeds, sacrificial help, those are the manifestations of love. You probably know someone somewhere at some time who's been falsely loving. Does that make sense? False sincerity is a really sickly, horrible thing. When somebody says nice things and tries to do nice things, but you know behind it all they really dislike you. You know they've got no time for you at all, but they're just saying the right thing because it's the right thing to do. It's one of the most transparent human failings. And it's really see-through. It's like the top coat. It's like the icing on the cake. And if the basic foundation of love isn't there, then the rest of it doesn't work. There's no point putting your makeup on if you've got a dirty face, is there? No point putting a clean shirt on if you've just been for a run and you're all sweaty and dirty. You wash first. Then you put your shirt on and your makeup on. Well, I do it in that order. You have to get the basic right. And so we've got to know what John is talking about. We have to know what he's talking about. So often our love for each other is a pretense. We try to look loving. But unless we're rooted in Christ's love for us, an agape, unconditional love. It doesn't mean that we've now got to go from here and start thinking, "Oh no, I've got to give everything away. I've got to welcome into my house anybody who asks. I've got to do..." What it means is that we take on a mantle of love and we change the way we relate to people so that when they're in our presence, there's something around us like a field of love, a force field of love. And when people come near, "Why are you different? What is it? You're just standing still. You're not even saying anything. You're not even doing anything, but I feel something." And I can name people that I know in this world that when I stand in their presence, I feel God. Because God lives in them and they live in God. That's what we aspire to. Martin Luther King Jr. said this, agape means recognition of the fact that all of life is interrelated. All of humanity is involved in a single process, and all men are brothers. Sisters as well. He wrote it in the 50s. And all men are brothers. To the degree that I harm my brother, no matter what he's doing to me, then to that extent I am harming myself. So what he's saying is that, a little bit with our circle of purposes, it's so interrelated that if we harm each other, we harm ourselves because it comes back to bite us. Because the circle is joined. So when we're unkind to someone, or when we think badly of someone, or when there's an undercurrent of unrest in the life of the church, or when relationships are broken in the life of the church, the only people who are really damaged by it are those who are being the ones who create unrest. Jesus calls us to live beyond it. So all things are interrelated. And as we just bring that to a close, just to say, that circle that we're working our way through, is each area is so much a part of the other area. And we want to really stress as we work through that we are all responsible for all the areas. We might not have skills in that field, or we might not actually put time and money into that field, but it's still ours nevertheless. It's still ours. We are working as a community. And so what one of us does as a member of the body of Christ, it affects the others. Like Paul's, you know, you stub your toe, your head will hurt. Because it affects the whole body. And isn't that, just to finish on a really positive note, isn't this amazing? It's amazing that when we cause damage, everybody gets damaged. But conversely, when we offer a word of encouragement, when we are pastorally sensitive, the whole of the church benefits, because it affects the whole body. And so when we all do that, suddenly we begin to understand the nature of care. And I have to say to you as I close, and these are not pious platitudes, I really mean it, this church is really good at pastoral care. I've served in lots of churches down the years. This church has got a real gift, and it's something to build on as we move forward together into a place where we all begin to really understand what it means to love with an agape, unconditional love because of who we are. Let's stand and sing.